Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio241, and it is April 15th, and we're going to start chapter 13, which is blood and a bit of the cardiovascular system today. Okay, so I can't tell you what's on the next test, because just a few seconds ago I thought the test was going to include chapters 13 and 14. But that's not true, because you weren't tested on 12 yet. So maybe it's just going to be 12 and 13. I'm not sure. I'll have to figure that out and let you know. Okay. All right, so you're getting your tests back in lab. A lot of people did really well. Congratulations. I would say most people got A's on the test. I don't know if that's really the case, because I didn't measure everybody's performance, but I would probably say probably at least half the class got some kind of A on the test, or really, really close to it. So really good. I know you have to apply yourself to do that, but if you apply yourself and study the material that I suggest on the study guide, okay, and you got time to do it, then you should be able to. Maybe that's not true for everybody, but if you're running into stumbling blocks, then see me during office hours, and chances are we can get you over some of those stumbling blocks. Okay. All right, so there's two tests left. All right, anybody have any questions? Sign-in sheet is going around. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Okay. The next test is April 29th, which is a Thursday. Yeah, it's in 2 weeks, something like that. Okay. All right, so probably you'll have two chapters on the test. This chapter that we're starting today actually is kind of long, and it's loaded with a lot of good stuff. So without further ado, let's start talking about the cardiovascular system, and in particular, the blood. Okay, so what is the function of, in particular, blood? We could say cardiovascular system, but blood is an important component of the cardiovascular system. And what kind of tissue is blood? It is a connective tissue, and it's kind of a strange connective tissue, because remember, it is a fluid connective tissue, and because it's a fluid, it flows, and since it flows throughout your whole body, it connects all the different parts of your body together. All right, so it transports oxygen and nutrients. It's loaded with enzymes to promote certain kinds of chemical reactions. Some of the enzymes are inactive but can be activated at a moment's notice. And of course, the circulatory system is used to deliver hormones to target tissues, to control target tissues from endocrine control. All right, but it also transports waste products from the cells that produce them to organs that are going to dispose of those waste products, like, for instance, carbon dioxide. How do you get rid of carbon dioxide? You breathe it out, right? So that's going to be a chapter coming up, the respiratory chapter. Well, we'll take a look at that. All right, another important function is that it transports heat. So heat transfer is an important part of the cardiovascular system. So when you're exercising and muscles are producing heat, it's picked up by the blood and delivered to the integument, and then you shed that heat maybe through sweating or through convection or some other kind of process. Blood is also important because it maintains fluid balance in your body and electrolyte balance and pH balance. Right, so it helps maintain hydrogen ion concentration. And the part of the lymphatic system involves the blood, so it protects you from disease-causing microorganisms and maybe even some macroorganisms, some foreign substances, and even tumors. Probably all of us have had a tumor in some point in our life, and you didn't even realize it because your immune system was able to detect it and kill the tumor before it ever became a dangerous tissue for you. Okay, and another important function of blood is, since it is a fluid, and if a hole is ever placed in a blood vessel, then that fluid is going to run out. So an important function of blood is that it should stop that blood loss if there is ever a loss of integrity of a blood vessel. All right, so that's another important function. And we're going to look at blood clotting. Okay, so the cardiovascular system includes the blood, the heart, blood vessels, as well as lymphatic systems. Right, so a heart pumps blood through the cardiovascular system. Blood vessels carry blood from the heart to cells. Ooh, what kind of vessel do we call that? What kind of vessel carries blood away from the heart to tissue spaces? That's an artery. That's right. And And then back, what kind of blood vessel brings blood back to the heart? Veins, that's right. So irrespective of what kind of compounds are in these blood vessels, whether it's high in oxygen or high in CO2, right, it's just the direction of flow that determines what's an artery or a vein, right? So you could tell me the name of an artery that is low in oxygen and high in CO2. The name of an artery that is low in oxygen but high in CO2. What is that artery? Vena cava is a vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart, okay? But the pulmonary artery. It's an artery because it's taking blood away from the heart. It's low in oxygen, high in CO2. It's going to the lungs to do what? To absorb oxygen and to release that CO2. Right, so that takes us to the third kind of blood vessel, and that is a capillary. So you should know what the function of a capillary is. It is for exchange. And you should also know why that is, the structural basis of why exchange takes place in the capillary from your anatomy class. Why is that? Why does exchange only take place in capillaries and not in arteries and veins, venules, or arterioles? Because of the thickness of the wall, of the vascular wall, right? So capillaries have very, very thin walls, and as a matter of fact, some are leaky. Somebody said some capillaries are fenestrated. They have holes in them, and so that allows for diffusion and even the bulk transport of materials through the walls of capillaries. Okay. The lymphatic system, on the other hand, it typically is acellular, but it does pick up excess tissue fluid and returns it to the cardiovascular system. So all of the fluid that leaves through a capillary does not get reabsorbed at that particular capillary. It ends up as extracellular fluid, and we would swell up every day and probably eventually burst like a water balloon if it were not for the lymphatic system recovering all of that fluid that's lost in a capillary bed and returns it to the cardiovascular system, or returns it to the blood. Okay, so blood. The way to think about blood, since it's a connective tissue, right, and it flows around, there are two main components for blood. There is the fluid part, which is what we call plasma. In terms of connective tissue, that would be the matrix, right? It's a fluid matrix. And then the second part of blood is what we call formed elements, and formed elements just means cells. So anything that's cells or cell-like in nature, then that's going to be a formed element. All right, so let's look in some detail for plasma. Plasma, of course, is mostly water, 92% water, and 8% proteins, and a very few of a percent are ions, nutrients, gases, and waste products. And of the proteins, these are the three main kinds of proteins that make up or that are dissolved in plasma. There is albumin that is made by the liver. And albumin is a protein. You know what? I think maybe on the next slide I'm going to talk about some of the more of the details of these different proteins. But if we have two compartments that has a high solute concentration, right, whether it's a protein or salt or whatever, and we have another compartment that's pure water, which way is water going to move? Is water going to move one way or the other? Okay, by diffusion, right? So if we have these proteins in our blood, namely albumins, then that's going to draw water from tissue spaces into the blood, right? So that's a very important way that your body prevents edema or the buildup of extracellular fluid in your body. So if you're low on albumins, you're going to have a problem with water balance. Water is going to stay in the extracellular space, and you're going to swell up as a result of that. Okay, globulins fight infections. They transport fatty materials around in our body, like steroids, for instance. And then another class of proteins would be clotting factors, and these are there to prevent blood loss. Okay, serum is a term that we use to talk about the fluid part of blood, but we have to take clotting factors out of it. So if we have Here we have plasma, which contains all of these ions and gases and proteins. If we take just the clotting factors out so that plasma can't clot, then we call that serum. So the interesting thing is that serum, right, does have antibodies in it to fight infections. So maybe you've heard of that term anti-serum. right? And an anti-serum just contains antibodies that can fight a particular antigen, but it doesn't have clotting factors, so it doesn't produce any kind of coagulopathies in anybody. All right, formed elements. We got three main kinds of formed elements, or cells. 95% of the formed elements are red blood cells. And another name for a red blood cell is erythrocyte. So erythro is just, means red, and cyte, of course, just means a cell. And this is kind of a strange cell because it does not have a nucleus. And since it does not have a nucleus, it cannot repair itself. It cannot replace proteins that are lost. So if you have a cell that can't repair itself, what do you think its lifespan is? Really, really short, okay? About 120 days. So you lose a tremendous number of red blood cells every day in your body. And so to prevent anemia, what does your body have to do? It has to make red blood cells. And as a matter of fact, you lose about 1 to 2 million red blood cells every second. So your body has to produce just that many. And we're going to look and see how that is controlled in a couple slides. All right. Less than 1% are white blood cells. These are nucleated cells. These do have a nucleus. Their lifespan is a little bit longer. These are called leukocytes. So leuko, of course, means white. In probably Latin, I think, is the root of that word. And the basic function of white blood cells is for immune response. It protects the body from infections. Different white blood cells play different kinds of functions, and I don't know how much we're going to get into the different kinds of functions. All right, and then, since an important function of blood is to prevent blood loss when a blood vessel is damaged, another formed element is called a platelet. And these are just cell fragments. They're very, very small. They are a nucleate as well, but they start the clotting process. Another name for a platelet is called a thrombocyte. So all three of these, red blood cells, white blood cells, and platelets, make up the formed elements in blood. Okay, so a lot of times we want to figure out if somebody is anemic or not by looking at the number of red blood cells. So here is a view underneath a microscope. I don't see a microscope on this slide, but let's pretend we're looking through a microscope, and this is what blood looks like underneath the microscope. So where I have the cursor right now, how would you describe where the cursor is right now? What part of blood is the cursor hovering over? That's a plasma, right? That's the matrix, okay? And then here is a formed element, right? Here's another formed element. I see some more formed elements over here. So if we have plasma with all of the formed elements, we call this whole blood, complete blood product right here. Do I see whole blood anywhere? Yeah, whole blood is what? If we were just to draw some blood out of somebody, this is what we would have, plasma plus all the formed elements. Okay, so there is a time when we're interested in calculating how many red blood cells make up a blood sample or a whole blood sample, and we want to measure that in terms of a percentage. All right, so we take whole blood from somebody, put it in a test tube and let it sit overnight, and all the heavy stuff, of course, is going to migrate down to the bottom of the tube, right? And all the light stuff or the lighter stuff will stay up at the top. So all the formed elements will be down here at the bottom of the test tube. Plasma will be up on the top. And then we just measure, right, compared to the total volume right here, what is the volume of red blood cells? That's the hematocrit. And in men, right, that's about 41 to 53%. All right, now in this particular sample, can you tell me what the hematocrit is? Would you say 50%? Can you see? Probably you could see. It is what? So here's the whole volume from here to here. What's the volume of just this red part? Yeah, it's certainly less than 50%. It's probably not an accurate diagram. It's just an illustration, but you should see that it's what? Certainly less than 50%. All right, so this probably, you know, if I were to pick man or woman, I would probably say, oh, this is probably what, female sample right here, okay? If it was 50%, then red blood cells would come up to about this level right here. That's just to give you an intuitive feel for what hematocrit is, but you should be able to calculate the hematocrit, right? So here is a question for you that you can work as homework, right? If we take an 80 milliliter sample of whole blood, and what's whole blood? Everything that's in blood, plasma with all the formed elements. From a normal individual, okay, contain 30 mLs of erythrocytes. 0.72 ml of leukocytes and 4 milliliters of thrombocytes after centrifuging, all right, is the sample from a man or a woman. So go ahead and calculate that and then tell me sometime if that's a man, a female, or male sample. All right, so that's just a check to see if you can calculate the hematocrit. Okay, so by putting it in a centrifuge, what does a centrifuge do? Yeah, it just makes this separation happen a lot faster, right? So instead of waiting overnight, you can actually calculate or measure somebody's hematocrit in like a minute or so. So all the heavy stuff goes to the bottom of the tube. All right, so that's hematocrit. The plasma proteins. Remember the three types were albumins, globulins, and fibrinogen. That's a clotting factor, fibrinogen. All right, albumins account for almost 80% of the proteins that are in blood. This creates a colloid osmotic pressure that draws water from the extracellular space back into the blood. So these albumins shouldn't leak out of a capillary. They should stay in the blood or inside the vasculature of somebody's body. And so when water builds up in the extracellular space, then water is drawn back into the cardiovascular system, and that helps, well, maintain the circulatory system, okay, and blood pressure. Right, these globulins carry lipids, and different kinds of globulins are antibodies which fight infections. And then this last part right here, fibrinogen, is a clotting factor which is important to prevent blood loss. And when we look at this term right here, I don't think we've described this before or previously, fibrinogen has an interesting suffix attached to it. What the heck is a suffix? It's a part of a word that you find where? Okay. It's at the end of the word, okay? And the suffix I'm looking at is ogen, right here. And whenever you see a word, well, most of the times when you see a word with an ogen in it, right, that means that this particular chemical is inactive. It's a precursor to an active chemical, right? And the active chemical here is fibrin. But the beauty is that fibrinogen can be converted into fibrin in just a very short notice, just within a second or two, right? And then fibrin produces some kind of function in the body that maintains homeostasis. The beauty of this system is that if you needed a lot of fibrin for whatever reason, but you had to build it de novo by protein synthesis, maybe it would take a day or two to build the proper level to maintain homeostasis, right? But since this is an important clotting function right here, fibrin, if you cut yourself really bad, but it's going to take you a day or two to build the proteins necessary to stop that bleeding, what's going to happen to you? Well, your history, right? So fibrinogen is really important because it acts as a reservoir or a reserve to make a lot of fibrin in a hurry in case you damage a blood vessel. So a lot of times you're going to see ogen right here. Just remember that that's a precursor molecule. It's there to make something happen in a hurry, but it's in reserve, right? It's inactive. Okay, and remember, if you have plasma and you take these clotting factors out of it, you get serum, which contains what? That albumin. So it's going to help maintain water balance in somebody if it's transfused, right? It has globulins, which will protect the individual from infectious agents, but it won't cause any kind of clotting abnormalities for somebody. That's what we call a serum. All right, formed elements. What do we want? Maybe I talked about this already. Erythrocytes. Well, I guess I didn't talk about all this stuff already, but here are the erythrocytes. Kind of looks like a donut, but the hole is kind of filled in a little bit. They lack a nucleus, so they have a very short lifespan, about 120 days, and you lose about 300 billion of these cells every day. So that's how many cells have to be made. And they're made in red bone marrow. That's the tissue that makes red blood cells, and that's what we call a hematopoietic tissue. A hematopoietic tissue is a kind that makes red blood cells. Okay, and the job of this erythrocyte is that it's loaded with a chemical compound that's used to transport oxygen. So that's the major role of an erythrocyte. So there really is no room inside this erythrocyte for organelles or a nucleus. It's packed with hemoglobin, So every red blood cell contains almost 300 million hemoglobin molecules for transporting oxygen, and every hemoglobin molecule can transport four oxygens. And so what's the importance of oxygen in the body again? We spent a lot of time on that at the beginning of the class, right? For what? Yeah, and we call that what? Aerobic respiration, for making a lot of ATP. Okay. All right, these leukocytes, on the other hand, are important for immune response. They fight infections, and there are a number of different kinds. I don't think I'm going to expect that you know what the functions of these different kinds in here are, but you should at least know that some of them are in the circulatory system, and they can actually crawl out of a capillary. So these are shapeshifters, and they can move around in various tissues looking for substances that don't belong in your body. And when they shift their shape, change their shape, we call that diapedesis. Right? So they're just always crawling around looking for antigens in your body. And then the immune system figures out a way to kill that particular antigen or get rid of it. The kind of white blood cell that is most common is a lymphocyte. And monocytes right here also play a very important role. These can leave the vascular system pretty easily. And when they leave the cardiovascular system and crawl around, then we call it a macrophage. So a monocyte is a precursor to a macrophage. Okay, and I think the only thing I'm going to say about a thrombocyte, these little platelets right here, is that they're important for blood clotting. Well, we'll take a look at what their function is in just a little bit. Okay, so hematopoiesis is the process of forming, as a matter of fact, specifically red blood cells. Hematopoiesis. So it's the formation of blood cells from stem cells in bone marrow, and in particular, red bone marrow. So red bone marrow is a hematopoietic tissue. Sometimes we call it a myeloid tissue. If we're going to consider the production of both white blood cells and red blood cells, we would call that a myeloid kind of tissue. Right? And so you produce about 500 billion blood cells every day. Oh, myeloid tissue is when it produces both white blood cells and red blood cells. And if you're considering just the process of producing white blood cells, that's called leukopoiesis. If it's just red blood cells, right, that's hematopoiesis. All right, so erythropoiesis is the formation of red blood cells. It's stimulated by a hormone, and that hormone is called erythropoietin. Erythropoietin is secreted by the kidney, so the kidney really is an endocrine gland that releases erythropoietin into the blood. And erythropoietin then travels to red bone marrow and stimulates the mitosis and differentiation of stem cells into red blood cells. Right? And it used to be that we had to recover erythropoietin from, I believe, cadavers. Maybe we got them from other that hormone from other animals as well. Okay, so you could imagine that administration of erythropoietin for somebody that was anemic was really expensive. But through genetic engineering techniques, right, the gene for this particular hormone was discovered and then was used to treat bacteria, and bacteria learned how to make this protein, and the genetically engineered form of erythropoietin is called EPO. So some of you might be familiar with EPO. That's the term that's used in hospitals, but of course in class you should know that is erythropoietin, and that it comes from the kidney. So the kidney measures oxygen tension or oxygen saturation in your blood, and as oxygen decreases, the kidney secretes erythropoietin, which produces more red blood cells, which brings oxygen back up to the proper level, right? And then the kidney stops producing so much erythropoietin. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, and we're not going to talk about leukopoiesis and the control of cytokines in regulating white blood cell production, but it's interesting. Maybe you should know something about that. Okay. I think I talked about everything on this slide already. But let me write some things on the board. All right, since red blood cells don't have a very long life, all right, so here's a red blood cell. It dies. And what's the chemical compound that's inside this red blood cell that's carrying oxygen? Hemoglobin. All right, so when this cell dies, it would be nice to recover some of the components of hemoglobin. All right, so hemoglobin then is processed, is broken down when the cell disappears into heme, and also then into globin. And I don't know, I didn't talk about this, but, well, sort of in a way. What's the building block of globin? We did see that in a PowerPoint slide today. Globulins, that's a protein that we find in blood, right? So it's a protein. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid, right? So then globin is broken down into amino acids, and what can you do with amino acids? You can make any kind of protein you want, right? So that's nice, by recovering all of those millions of molecules of hemoglobin. Heme, on the other hand, is not a carbohydrate, it's not a lipid, not a protein, not a nucleic acid. It's an organic compound, but it's kind of a strange one, right? Heme is broken down into iron, right, which just is an element. So that's what oxygen actually binds to. Okay, and another compound that we call bilirubin. So your body then can recycle this iron right here, and then bilirubin is excreted in the body. Okay, and bilirubin has kind of a bright yellow color to it. So this process happens in the liver. All right, so if somebody is losing too many red blood cells through some kind of process, some kind of pathological process, then there's going to be an excess of bilirubin building up in the body. And what's going to happen to their color? It's going to change from whatever it is to a bright yellow color. And you can always see this in a part of a person's body that is bright white. What's a part of somebody's body that's normally bright white? Like the sclera of their eyes. Okay, so, and what do we call that when somebody has a buildup of bilirubin right here? That's jaundice, right? Okay. Another cause for jaundice is, since this process happens in the liver, if the liver isn't processing this properly, okay, so if liver disease, like for liver cirrhosis, might produce jaundice as well, okay, because of the buildup of bilirubin. All right, so a lot of the products of hemoglobin can be recycled, but not all of them. That mostly happens in the liver. Okay, so let's talk specifically about erythropoiesis. When there is low blood oxygen, the liver and the kidney, primarily the kidney, can detect low blood oxygen. And what's the cell responsible for delivering oxygen to the body? Yeah, red blood cells, right? So the kidney releases erythropoietin into the blood. So both the liver and the kidney have that endocrine function. And erythropoietin then gets delivered to red bone marrow. What would we call red bone marrow in this process? Since this hormone is going to change the metabolism of red bone marrow, what do we call red bone marrow? That is a target tissue. So red bone is a target tissue for erythropoietin. So what makes red bone marrow a target tissue? What makes red bone marrow a target tissue for erythropoietin and not, say, the cerebellum or some other tissue in your body? Because it has to have a receptor for erythropoietin, right? It's got to have a receptor, right? And when erythropoietin binds to that receptor, then that's going to stimulate erythropoiesis. There's going to be an increased number of red blood cells, and hopefully you have iron in your diet and good amino acids in your diet, And you can make a proper hemoglobin. And so then oxygen concentration increases in the blood, and you can see that does what? That feeds back, and does that subtract to or add to the stimulus? That subtracts from the stimulus. So this is a nice one, negative feedback loop. Okay, so you got to know what organs secrete erythropoietin. All right, and that's for carrying oxygen. All right, so there is another function of blood, and that's the immune function of blood. So we're going to talk about different blood groups right at the moment. Okay. And if we have a cell, there's a plasma membrane surrounding every cell. And what's a nice sophisticated way to think of a plasma membrane? Phospholipid bilayer. Okay, so there's two layers of phospholipid. But what else about membranes? What else can happen to a membrane besides just a phospholipid bilayer? It's semi-permeable. Some things can go through, some can't, based on their physical chemistry. Namely, lipid molecules can go across, but hydrophilic compounds can't. All right, but not in all cases. You know that sodium can go across the membrane. How does sodium get across the membrane? There are channels, and what are those channels made out of? Yeah, protein. So besides the phospholipid bilayer, the plasma membrane can also be incorporated with various kinds of proteins, like channels. What's another kind of protein that can be inserted into the plasma membrane to change its function? G proteins for signal transduction. So you got ion channels, you got G proteins. What about a target tissue? What does it have? It's got receptors. So it's got receptor proteins, right? So there is a whole bunch of different kinds of proteins that can be incorporated into the plasma membrane to give that cell or the plasma membrane special functions, right? And what kind of way do we use to think about and talk about that kind of membrane? Not just a simple phospholipid bilayer, but what? There's a model that you should have in your mind that describes all of the complexities that can develop from the plasma membrane. We call that the fluid mosaic model, right? The phospholipid bilayer it wants to update or something? Restart now, restart later. Thanks for letting me know. Because it's gonna be very persistent for the next 5 hours that it wants to do that. But I'll let you go before then. All right, so the fluid mosaic model. All right, so the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, but there's a lot of stuff added to the plasma membrane to confer all kinds of special functions, like membrane channels and receptors, right? There's another kind of protein that maybe we talked about when we talked about the cell, and that is an antigen. So in the plasma membrane is another kind of chemical compound that is sticking out of the plasma membrane, and it's part protein and part sugar. So it's a mucopolysaccharide. And sugars can be very branched, okay, can have a very kind of branch pattern like that. So this is what we call an antigen right here. So an antigen is a molecule that has a particular shape, and in your body there are various kinds of antigens, and they're all very particular to you. All right, so all of your cells might have an antigen that looks like that. And your brothers and sisters might have an antigen that kind of look like, maybe like that, which is similar but a little bit different, right? So these antigens are like an address that says this cell belongs to your body. And if a cell comes into your body that has a different shaped antigen, then your immune system knows that that cell is what? From outside your body, doesn't belong. And then the immune system is going to try to destroy that cell, so it doesn't take advantage of you. All right, so these are antigens sticking off the cell membrane. The other thing that we see, and all cells have that, including red blood cells. So if your body wants to fight that particular antigen, it has to make an antibody. An antibody will bind to this antigen, and I bet you could imagine what is the basic process that an antibody can recognize a particular antigen. by the shape, right? So the antibody has to have a complementary shape to this antigen right here. Okay, and antibodies kind of look like this. There's a couple of parallel protein strands, and then there are some arms sticking out of it like that. And then there are some receptor parts that actually look like hands that are sticking up. So there are two hands. And let's just say that this cell, all right, has an antigen that looks like that, sticking off of it. And if your body wants to fight that particular cell, what do you think should be the shape of this hand right here? It should be complementary to that B, right? So it should look something like that, so that B fits right in there. All right, so that's the job of your immune system, is to figure out how to make the shapes of these hands right there to bind various antigens. Okay. All right, so here is antibody. What kind of protein are these antibodies again? Antigen right here. They're globulins, right? And they're in your blood. Some are in your blood all the time from birth. Other antibodies, your body has to learn how to build, and that's how you develop immune system when you're very, very young. Okay. All right, so now let's look at the slide that we have right here. All right, so where do we have antigens? They're present on the surface of red blood cells. As a matter of fact, every cell in your body. Okay. One major antigen group, there are many different kinds of groups, right? But one major one is what we call the ABO system. Right? And this is very important for blood because it can cause the clumping of red blood cells together, right? And we call that agglutination. Right? And that's going to, and agglutination is a process when an antibody binds to an antigen. So it's a antigen-antibody reaction. It's an immune reaction. Agglutination. Maybe I have it on the next slide. Agglutination. Okay, agglutination. So there are two important processes that we're going to talk about today. One is agglutination, and the other is coagulation. And you got to be really straight in your mind the difference between those two different processes. So we're going to talk about agglutination first. So agglutination is what? An interaction between an antibody and an antigen. All right, that's going to cause agglutination or clumping. All right, so when they first started studying blood, they saw that, scientists saw that blood can clump together and it looked different than coagulation. All right, and so they isolated an antibody that would cause agglutination. So what would you call the first antibody that you found that caused agglutination? What would you call that? You could call it one. They called it A. Right? And so they said, well, we have this antibody right here that's binding to something on the surface of a red blood cell, and let's call that A. Not that the antigen actually has the shape of an A, but that's the first one that they found, right? All right, so what's the shape of these receptors right here? What does it have to be? Let's make it more look like this. What does it have to look like? Yeah, it has to look kind of like a little witch's hat. Okay? So that this will fit into or bind to this antigen right here. All right, so here we have a red blood cell with an A sticking off of it, and here we got another red blood cell with an A on it, like this. And what can happen to these two red blood cells? They can get glued together as a result of an interaction with this antibody, right? So this is going to bind here, this is going to bind here. All right, so here is the antibody binding these two red blood cells, and then what can happen over here? And over here? Well, you can have, right, I'll just kind of loosely draw that. You can clump millions of red blood cells together because every antibody has these two arms. Right, so all of the cells, all the red blood cells in your body can be clumped together, and of course that would be a terrible thing to happen if that did happen. All right, so they're messing around with blood, and then all of a sudden somebody discovers another kind of antigen, has a different shape on the surface of the red blood cell that doesn't interact with this antibody, but it interacts with a different antibody in the blood. What would you call that one? Then you would call that one B. All right, so they found another red blood cell that has a different shape, not that the antigen had a B, but a different kind of shape to it. All right, and then you know the shape of the receptor has to match with that one. And then they're messing around with blood, and then they found some blood, right, and it didn't have an A antigen or a B antigen on it. What would you call that one? That's close. You could call that AB. You could call it C. Okay, but somebody said, well, it doesn't have any antigens on it. Let's call it zero. And then a bunch of people cringe and said, oh, God, no, we can't have A, B, and zero. So then somebody said, oh, I got an idea. Let's call it O. Okay, so O is a kind of cell that has neither A or B what on the surface of the plasma membrane? Antigen, right? So where do you find antigens all the time? On the cell membrane. Where do you find antibodies? In the plasma. They're soluble in plasma because it's a plasma protein. Okay? And what do we call that process of an association with an antibody and an antigen? That is agglutination. Okay, so what are the possible blood types? We've got blood type A, we've got blood type B, we've got O, and then we also have a blood type that has both A and B on it. And that's what we call blood type, somebody said over here, that would be AB, right? So those are the blood types. All right, so it's never a good idea, of course, for you to produce antibodies against the blood type that you have. You should produce antibodies in some cases against blood type that you don't have, right? Because otherwise your own blood would agglutinate. That's not good. So here is a table probably you should draw. And so let's start drawing this table out. And don't forget, what are the two components of this agglutination system? Antibody and antigen. All right, let me see if I can remember how to make this table. We've got, across the top, let's put the different kinds of blood types we have. What do we got? We got A, we got B, we got AB, and then we got O. Okay, not quite like that. And what are the two components that are going to interact again? We've got antigen. Yeah. Antigen. Where is the antigen located? Okay. Who's really computer smart? How can I make this go away for good? Yeah, hit restart. No, restart later. Okay, so antigen is located where? Plasma membrane. Antibody is located where? In plasma, the fluid part of blood, right? All right, so if your blood type A, my marker, hopefully my marker is dark enough for you to see all the way in the back. If your blood type A, do you have any antigens? What antigens do you have? You've got the A antigen, and it's on the cell membrane. Okay? And it just so happens, if your blood type A, your body automatically makes an antibody against antigen B. All right, so, and you're kind of born with that. So you have what? You have anti-B, ready to go. And if your blood type, let me just kind of fill that in right here. And if your blood type B, what kind of antigen you have? You have the B antigen automatically on the plasma membrane, and you automatically make anti, you can't make anti-B, because that would kill your blood, you have anti-A. All right, and if you're a person with type AB blood, you have both A and B antigens. Now, what about antibodies? You can't make any of those antibodies, so none. You have none. And then if you're blood type O, you've got none, right? You got no antigens, and you have both anti-A and anti-B. All right, so that's how blood works, right, which is what this slide here says, in a way. All right, so this here's a little table that kind of shows that. Here's the antibody, okay? That process is what we call agglutination. All right, when an antibody antigen reaction. The shapes of the antigen have to match up in a complementary sense to the antibody. All right, so when somebody is transfused, of course, the blood has to be cross-matched and typed so that when you transfuse, you get the proper antigens and antibodies in a person. All right, type O is a universal donor because it lacks the A and B antigens. All right, so recipient's antibodies won't agglutinate the donor type O red blood cells. All right, and type AB is what we call the universal recipient because the recipient doesn't make anti-A or anti-B antibodies, so it won't agglutinate somebody's blood. All right, now in a typical medical setting right now, we would never ever think of transfusing somebody unless there was a perfect match of blood, okay, because it's still pretty risky. So for instance, if you got into a car accident, found your way to emergency room, and you're hemorrhaging, and you said, oh, I know exactly what my blood type is, I need to be transfused right away, I'm blood type A, guess what they would do? They would do blood type and cross match anyway, right? Because it's just not one blood clotting system. This is just the ABO system, but there are other important blood clotting systems in your blood that might interact and cause agglutination, right? So they got to check a range of them. And another kind of system for agglutination is the Rh factor type system. And Rh comes from where they found this particular antigen in an animal model that they were studying, and that was a rhesus monkey, and so they call it Rh from the rhesus monkey. And you either have that antigen on your red blood cell, right? Because is that where you have antigens? Absolutely. All right, so now you have this Rh antigen sticking off. And if somebody has this antigen, we call that Rh plus. And if they have a red blood cell that looks like that in terms of the Rh, that would be, we call that minus. Okay? That's minus. So you should be able to put both of these together. I might give you a red blood cell on the test and you have to tell me what blood type it is in terms of the ABO system as well as the Rh system. And we can do a couple examples on the board. Okay. Now the interesting thing about this Rh system right here, of course, somebody that's Rh positive is never going to make an Rh antibody, right? That's for sure. All right. If you're Rh negative, you do not automatically make anti-Rh right here. It's only if you are exposed to an Rh positive sample of some kind. If you're transfused, or maybe you're pregnant and you're Rh negative and your baby's Rh positive, then you can become sensitized to this antigen right here. All right? And then if you're pre-sensitized, then you will make an anti-Rh factor. And that is important because if you're pregnant a second time and you have anti-Rh in your blood and if your second baby is Rh positive, what can happen? What's that process? What do we call that process? Yeah, agglutination. All right, so this maternal antibody can destroy these fetal red blood cells. Right, and that's kind of a terrible process. We call that erythroblastosis fetalis or hemolytic disease of the newborn. And we certainly want to know if this is happening. And this is why years ago you always had to get a blood test to get a marriage license. It's not so important today, because it's so easily treated and we really know what's going on. But, for instance, if erythroblastosis fetalis does take place in the infant, tell me something about what's happening to the infant if a bunch of their red blood cells are agglutinating, and when blood agglutinates, the cells lyse. All right, the cells actually break down and release hemoglobin into the blood, and the liver has to deal with it. Tell me something about that fetus or the newborn baby that's experiencing erythroblastosis fetalis. Because all that hemoglobin is breaking down into bilirubin. Okay, and so the neonate is going to be jaundiced. And bilirubin is also a neurotoxin, especially in a developing central nervous system. All right, so that's why we really want to know about this ahead of time with good prenatal care. Okay. One interesting kind of question is, if you in terms of the ABO system, it's very possible, okay, for the mom to be A and the baby to be AB, but this doesn't cause that particular problem. It's only this Rh factor. Why is that? And the answer is because this Rh antibody right here is really small. The anti-A and anti-B antibody is relatively big. So the anti-Rh antibody can go across the placenta into the fetus, but the antibody A and antibody B is very big and can't cross the placenta, so it doesn't cause problems. So that's the trick with that one. All right, so let's do a little test. You tell me what blood type it is. Okay, so here is, what's that? Nice red blood cell. Okay, now what's the blood type? You're half right. Somebody said O. But O what? Okay. In terms of the Rh factor, do you see an Rh antigen on there? No. So is that plus or minus? Minus. So that would be O minus. That would be the blood type of that particular person. Okay. Now, what would be the blood type of that? O positive. Okay. And what would be the blood type of this one? A positive. Right. And what would be that one? A negative. So do you see what's going on? What would be this one? AB. Negative. Right? And then this would be AB positive. All right, so I might draw a red blood cell, and then you should be able to tell me what kind of antibodies would this person be making? None. Can't make any. Right? Because if it made anti-A, they would agglutinate their own blood. Can't make anti-B because they would agglutinate their own blood. Can't make anti-RH because they would agglutinate their own blood. So that person would contain no antibodies at all, one way or the other. Okay, who's got a question about blood types and what's that process called again? Agglutination. And what's the best way to describe the agglutination process? It's what? Restart now. It's called an antibody antigen reaction, right? It's an immune response, which is different than blood clotting, which is, I think, what we're going to talk about right now, right? So agglutination is an antibody antigen reaction, not a blood clotting function. All right, so let's talk about that blood clotting function. Hemostasis is a term that's used to denote cessation of bleeding when bleeding occurs, right? So it's the maintenance of proper blood inside your body. All right, there are two kinds of hemostasis. There is platelet plug formation, which requires what? Platelets. What can you tell me about a platelet that you learned from the beginning part of the lecture? What's a platelet? It's a cell fragment. It's a part of what? It's a formed element, right? It's a part of the formed elements in your blood, the platelet. Ooh. Oh, wow. I think maybe I'm just going to leave that like that for right now. I'm not awake enough. I don't want to lose any fingers with that thing. Okay, that's a formed element. It's a cell fragment, very, very small cell. Okay, and then there's fibrin formation. And where does fibrin come from? This is a review. It comes from fibrinogen, right? And so platelet plug formation is good for very small tears in blood vessels, like microscopic tears. Maybe if you exercise very heavily, you might tear a small blood vessel like a capillary or a venule or something. Fibrin formation or coagulation is for much larger insults to blood vessels. Okay, much larger injuries to blood vessels. And fibrin is a protein that forms a knot. A net. It's like a fish net that builds up over a tear in a blood vessel. And that fish net then traps red blood cells and white blood cells as blood is leaking out through that injury. And that forms a blood clot. Okay, so the two terms today you got to know something about is coagulation, right? Coagulation really is another way of saying what? Fibrin formation. But agglutination is antibody-antigen reaction. Two totally different kinds of things. Okay. All right, so let's look at platelet plug formation first. All right, so normally platelets don't stick together. Right, when there is an intact endothelium, so here we see a blood vessel. Here is the endothelium, right? That's just a nice, simple, squamous epithelium that lines every blood vessel and lines the heart. Of course, we call that the endocardium then. Right, and then underneath the endocardium, we have collagen, right? We have connective tissue underneath this epithelium right here. Right, and this healthy epithelium is releasing nitric oxide and a prostaglandin, which we call PGI2. And there are certain proteins in the membranes of this protein that can destroy ADP and convert it into AMP. And when there's very low levels of ADP in the blood, that maintains platelets in an inactive form. Even though these kind of look like red blood cells right here, maybe just think of them as platelets for the moment. Okay. All right, so these compounds right here prevent these platelets from sticking together. All right, and right, if there's damage to the endothelium, then of course we have the collagen fibers brushing up against the plasma and the blood. Okay, and there are these little factors right here that are called the von Willebrand factors, and this von Willebrand factor increases the binding of collagen to platelets. And when they start to stick to collagen, these platelets release ADP. Right? And this ADP is going to cause more platelets to stick together. And the platelets also release thromboxane A2, which is another factor which enhances the stickiness of these platelets. So this is what we call the platelet release reaction, and you can see that it is kind of like a positive feedback mechanism, right? Where one factor enhances the activity of another factor and the buildup of ADP, and so platelets start to stick together in this region right here, and then that blocks off this this break in the blood vessel. Now, how large is this break in the blood vessel? Because here you see just one cell. So this works for very, very small kinds of tears in blood vessels. And aspirin is used kind of as an anticoagulation therapy because aspirin blocks the synthesis of pretty much all prostaglandins in the body, including TXA2, right? And so that blocks this platelet release reaction, right? So aspirin can be used as an anticoagulant. Or it does if you take aspirin. All right, so here you have the formation of that plug, the platelet plug, as a result. All right, so now let's talk about coagulation, the second kind of hemostasis. When the platelet plugs becomes infiltrated with a net of fibrin. All right, so now the clot contains platelets, fibrin, and bunches of trapped red blood cells. And then the plug goes into contraction to form a more compacted plug that we call a blood clot. All right, so I don't think I want to read this to you, but I do want to show you this scheme right here. And I think this is an exam figure. So let's look at this particular figure right here. All right, so here we got coagulation. And let's look at the bottom line first. What's the bottom line for coagulation? Is it an antibody-antigen reaction? It is fibrin formation. Look way down over here. So this is actually what we're shooting for. Fibrin formation. And where does fibrin come from? Fibrinogen. And maybe on the next slide I got a picture of what it looks like. Ah, here's what it looks like. All right, so here is the network of all these fibrin proteins. So fibrin is insoluble in plasma. It precipitates out. It cannot stay in a soluble form. But what about fibrinogen? It's soluble in plasma, right? So it stays in solution. Okay. As a matter of fact, this is not a bad thing to answer right now. Coagulation is what kind of formation? Fibrin formation, the forming of this net right here. Okay, well, how does that happen? Okay, we see that it can happen with a three-step process. So we see some complications right here, which we're going to go over in just a little bit. But the first thing is that you should visualize coagulation as a three-step process. Okay, and here are the three steps. Prothrombin activator formation. And there are a number of different clotting factors, right? Prothrombin activator is called 10A or XA. That's just one of the clotting factors. Let's talk about prothrombin for just a little bit. Okay, fibrinogen, we said, had a suffix attached to it, namely ogen, which means what? Fibrinogen is inactive but can be converted into an active form very quickly to make fibrin, right, to stop bleeding. All right, there's another way that we can talk about a precursor molecule, and that is not with another suffix, but with a prefix, and that prefix is pro. All right, so if you ever see, or a lot of times when you see the name of an enzyme with a pro as a prefix, that also means that it is a precursor. It's an inactive form, but it can be changed into an active form very quickly so that you don't have to de novo make this particular protein from amino acids. So it can be built up in the body very, very quickly. All right, so prothrombin is a precursor to what compound? Thrombin, yeah. So thrombin is an important enzyme in this blood clotting process right here. Okay, so prothrombin can be converted into thrombin by prothrombin activator. Okay. All right, and then thrombin is used to convert fibrinogen to fibrin. All right, so those are the three steps. First, you got to have something that's going to convert prothrombin into thrombin. Right, when that becomes activated, then thrombin can build up inside the blood. And then the third step is when thrombin is available, then fibrin formation can take place. All right, so here you have a three-step process. So thrombin is an enzyme, and what happens when it's doing its job? Does it get used up? No, right? So it can convert many molecules of fibrinogen into fibrin, right? And prothrombin activator, which we see right here, is an enzyme that can convert prothrombin to thrombin, and that activator, of course, since it's an enzyme, doesn't get used up as well either, right? So if you have one enzyme, one prothrombin activator, how many thrombins can it make? Thousands. So going from one molecule to thousands of molecules, what do we call that? We call that, it's close, amplification. Okay, that's amplification, going from one molecule, one kind of molecule, to thousands. All right, but what do we see here? Thrombin is an enzyme. If you make thousands of thrombins, you can make what? Millions of fibrins. So what's that? That's another level of amplification. And if you have multiple levels of amplification, what do we call that? That's a cascade mechanism, right? So here we have a number of levels of amplification. That is a cascade mechanism, which does what? It makes something happen in a big way in a hurry, right? So coagulation happens in a big way in a hurry because of amplification and this cascade mechanism right here. Okay, so there are three pathways involved for coagulation. There's an extrinsic pathway, a common pathway, and an intrinsic pathway, right? And usually the extrinsic pathway is what happens inside your body. And this is a result of revealing collagen to plasma, right, when a blood vessel is damaged. And so we see a number of different clotting factors, and I'm not going to ask you to know a bunch of these different clotting factors because they were all discovered at different times. And so sometimes you see clotting factor, say for instance, clotting factor 5 comes after clotting factor 10, and that's because they discovered clotting factor 5 before 10, even though it doesn't happen in a physiologic role just that way. Okay, so there are a number of different clotting factors. Most of these clotting factors are made by the liver. They're produced by the liver. So when you have liver disease, or for instance, if you have liver cirrhosis, what is one function in your body that's depressed? Coagulation. You have a coagulopathy due to liver disease. All right, so these are produced in the liver, including prothrombin and fibrinogen. Okay, another thing that you notice is that there is an ion that's necessary for these pathways to take place, both the extrinsic pathway, intrinsic pathway, and the common pathway. In order to have proper clotting function, what is the ion that you need in the plasma? Do you see that on the list anywhere? Yeah, calcium. You need to have the proper levels of calcium here, here, and here. Okay? So again, that just kind of underscores the importance of regulating calcium in your body. It's important, of course, to have strong bones, but that's like the last place in the body that you want to have the proper levels of calcium. You need it in your blood so that you don't bleed to death. Okay. So these various clotting factors become activated, okay, whether it's the intrinsic or extrinsic pathway, and they both feed into this common pathway right over here, which activates prothrombin activator, right? So clotting factor 10, when it becomes activated, we call that 10A or XA. That's prothrombin activator. And then that converts prothrombin to thrombin. And thrombin then works on fibrinogen to make that net that forms a blood clot. Right? Thrombin not only converts fibrinogen to fibrin, but it also activates other clotting factors in the intrinsic pathway. Right? So if this activates more clotting factors in the intrinsic pathway, what does that do to the production of more thrombin? Right? If thrombin can be used to make to activate more clotting factors in the intrinsic pathway, that produces more thrombin. And when you have more thrombin producing more clotting factors, that produces more thrombin. What kind of feedback mechanism is that? That's a nice positive feedback mechanism. So that's another thing that I want you to be aware of in this particular diagram, is that here is another positive feedback mechanism, which usually is a sign of a disease process, but in terms of this process, it's what? It's a normal and healthy process that's going to maintain homeostasis. Okay, and heparin is used as an anticoagulant because it blocks thrombin, right? So it destroys this positive feedback mechanism so that coagulation does not proceed as normal. It also blocks the production of fibrin from fibrinogen. Have you ever heard of a condition called hemophilia? Okay, hemophilia occurs, and I have to do a web search. I don't know if there are any hemophiliacs even still alive today. Are there? I'm really glad to hear that, because I had a number of friends that were hemophiliacs when I was growing up, but I was wondering if there were any alive today, because one way to treat hemophilia, well, first I got to tell you what hemophilia is. Since, okay, patients with hemophilia or people with hemophilia have no clotting factor 8, their bodies can't make it, then this intrinsic pathway doesn't exist in them. And this intrinsic pathway is really important for the proper building up the proper levels of thrombin because of what? Because of this positive feedback mechanism. So hemophiliacs don't have this positive feedback mechanism in their blood clotting pathway, and as a result, can't produce sufficient fibrin to stop bleeding. Even if you get a little paper cut, somebody with hemophilia could eventually bleed to death as a result of that. Right, so that's pretty startling, right? Because of this positive feedback mechanism is blocked. And so I was just wondering if there are any hemophiliacs today, because one way to treat hemophilia is with blood transfusions so that they get the proper levels of clotting factor 8. Okay, and one of the things way back when, I can't even remember how many years ago it was now, there was a disease process, there was an infection transmitted by the blood, and for years we didn't know about it. We didn't know how to test it, we didn't know what it was all about, and that was what? Yeah, AIDS, acquired immunodeficiency syndrome by the HIV virus. So patients that needed a lot of transfusions, maybe patients with sickle cell anemia and with hemophilia, they were really just kind of wiped out as a result of medical practice, but nobody knew any different, right? Now it's relatively safe because, of course, blood is always tested for HIV. Not that somebody can't make a mistake, but now it's at least tested for. So I was just wondering, so the incidence of hemophilia, I'm sure, was drastically reduced before we really knew to test for HIV viruses. Okay, and maybe even today, I'm not sure, maybe there's a way with genetic engineering techniques to build clotting factor 8 to where people don't need transfusions with hemophilia. I don't know, I can maybe look that up, or somebody can do a Google and tell us about that next time. You'd give factor 8? Okay. Do you know if that's a genetically engineered aid, or do we get that from...
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Some kind of implant for hemophilia? Oh, that's pretty cool. Right. Right. Okay, so try to think of this three-step process when we talk about coagulation next time. I think I maybe want to talk about a few other details of this next time. So look at your exam figure. You don't have to reproduce this figure exactly, but there are some question marks sprinkled around in here for some of the key salient features of coagulation. All right, but the bottom line, coagulation is fibrin formation, and agglutination is what? An antibody-antigen reaction. Okay. All right, so that's where I'm going to stop for today.